When they see an asshole on the road, they just shake their heads and laugh, and it works. Guys, we have got to relax. We're damaging our hearts with every minute of uptight, tense, and angry behavior. Quit walking around like you've got a pineapple up your ass. Nothing matters that much. Except a real pineapple. That would matter something awful. 2. Lighten up on the food and drink. We need to think more about what we put in our mouths. If you and I would eat less and drink less, we'd live a lot longer. When's the last time you saw a woman pig out like it was her last meal? Sure, we've all seen women pound back the liquor, but how many females have you seen just drop their pants and start peeing on the curb? Why do you think so many of us men get colon and stomach cancer and liver disease? Because we can't say no to Jack Daniels or Jim Beam or a pound and a half of half-cooked beef topped with fried onion rings, year-old jalapenos, and Tabasco sauce? There's a reason you've never seen a woman take a newspaper into a bathroom. Get a clue. 3. Step aside. You'll live longer. Listen, why don't we retire and let women run the world? Okay, so you don't want women having power because you're a conservative redneck, but what would you say if I told you that letting them worry about building that nuclear plant in Bahrain, or declaring war against China, or finding a solution to the continuing abuse of the infield fly rule would give us men 8 more years of life? Let's step aside and shut up. Is it that big a cheap thrill just to be the boss and have to deal with hundreds of employees and all their crap? Who needs it? Let's back off, take a break, and let the women have this crazy, unmanageable world for the next 10,000 years. Think of all the reading you'll catch up on. 4. Wash your hands across America. It's time to wise up. Our personal habits are so revolting, it's a wonder women are willing even to breathe the same air we do. If we men could only get our act together and change a few simple things, we'd immediately score more empathy and companionship. For starters, we should keep our hands where they belong. They weren't intended to be used in nostrils, anuses, ears, or navels. They were not designed to tear out articles from the newspaper before she has a chance to read it, or to pick a loose piece of kielbasa skin from between your teeth, or to sandpaper that patch of dandruff on your head. Stop checking and adjusting your crotch in public. Nothing has disappeared since your last inventory roughly a minute ago. Keep your legs together so you don't take up 3 seats on buses and trains. Wear underwear. Preferably underwear that's been washed this year in a washing machine with actual laundry soap. 5. Learn how a toilet seat works. All right, boys. I thought for sure we'd be over this by now, but the foul evidence in airports and train stations and fast food emporia all over this great land tells me this. Despite the constant carping of TV comics everywhere, we just haven't gotten the message. So, here's a quick refresher course. First, remove the movable oval cover into an upright position. Then lift the movable oval seat beneath it into an upright position. They will both automatically lock into place. That's so you can use both hands. It's just like steering a car. You wouldn't want the car to go off the road, would you? Fine. And the women in your house feel the same way about your piss all over the wallpaper. Aim, hold, release, return to pants. Take one hand and gently return oval seat and its top to their lowered positions. No audible sound of the seat hitting the ceramic bowl should be heard. Grasp the little silver handle at left and flush. This is not optional, even in a public restroom. If the first flush doesn't take, you may not leave the scene. Stay there till you're looking at a clean bowl. Wash hands. Dry them on the towels provided, not the shirt you're wearing. Throw the paper towel into the trash receptacle, or if the towel is made of cloth, place it back on towel rack, usually a metal or plastic rod protruding from the wall near the sink. If you're in your own home, put the cloth towel into the laundry at least once a week. Wash, return to bathroom. 6. Bathe daily. Throwing some water in your face to wake up in the morning does not constitute bathing. Neither does being doused with a Heineken at a party the night before. Step into the tub. Turn handle halfway between hot and cold. Lift stem on faucet to create shower effect. Take bar of soap and washcloth and scrub all areas of the body. Do not place the bar of soap in body cavities to get them extra clean. Someone else has to use that bar of soap on her face. Rinse. When finished, leave shower area and dry off, creating as little a water trail as possible. 7. Tone it down. Lower your voice. Try listening. Here's how it works. When someone else is talking, pay close attention to what they are saying. Maintain eye contact. Do not interrupt. When he or she is finished, pause and reflect on what was said. Try saying nothing at all. Notice how what you have heard is stimulating thoughts, concepts, feelings, and ideas in your head. This may lead to something brilliant. You will then be able to take those ideas, claim them as yours, and become famous. 8. Get your hearing checked. If the above doesn't work, there may be something physically wrong with you. May is National Better Health and Speech Month. Many hospitals and community groups offer free screening for hearing loss. Check your local newspaper for announcements of free hearing tests in your area. In addition, most hospitals offer periodic free hearing tests throughout the year. You can also find online quizzes to help you determine if you should seek a professional hearing evaluation. 9. Know that women are onto us. Cut out the sensitive man crap. They know the drill. Don't try convincing anyone you're a feminist. You don't qualify. You play for the other team. It's like a Klansman chanting, "Keep hope alive." You are a specimen of the gender that will always make more money, that will always have the door swing open wide and far to wherever you want to go in life. This does not mean you can't help make things better. The best way to help women is to work on your fellow men. That's where the real struggle is, getting enlightenment through the concrete block known as a man's head. Help end the wage gap by looking at your own paycheck. Make sure women doing the same job at work are getting paid the same as you. Participate in Equal Pay Day, usually held in early April, on the day that marks the point in the new year when a woman has finally earned the wages paid to a man in a comparable job during the previous year. And you can join in the effort to push Congress to pass 2 pieces of national legislation affecting equal pay. The Fair Pay Act would allow women to bring suit based on the principle of equal pay for equal work, and would allow employees within a single company to sue if they believe they are being paid less than someone with an equivalent job and equivalent training. The Paycheck Fairness Act provides for higher damages in these types of lawsuits and protects employees who share salary information. The Center for Policy Alternatives has been working to pay equity for the past 25 years. Finally, join a union, or try to start one. According to the AFL-CIO, a 30-year-old female union member making $30,000 a year stands to lose about $650,133 over a lifetime because of unequal pay. If she's not a union member, on the other hand, she'll lose about $870,327. If you convince the other men on the job to unionize the establishment, then you'll have greatly improved your female co-workers' lives and your own. How women can survive without men. 1. Visit a sperm bank or an adoption agency. Most communities have adoption agencies or sperm banks available for women who would love to have children but for whatever reason want to do it without a man. It's good for kids to have 2 parents and easier for the parents too, but everything you've heard about how damaged children turn out to be if they were raised by a single mother, well, that's one of the big lies of our culture. In his book, The Culture of Fear, Barry Glassner points out that those raised by single mothers had income and education levels roughly equal to those raised by 2 parents. Research shows that as a group, children of single moms tend to fare better emotionally and socially than do offspring from high-conflict marriages, or from those in which the father is emotionally absent or abusive. 2. Learn where to buy a stepladder. There are many fine brands, sizes, and styles available at affordable prices. Try Home Depot. And for further information about this revolutionary invention, go to the American Ladder Institute website. Number 3. When all else fails, love yourself. How to survive your bed being set on fire. Get on the floor and crawl. Stay low. If you can, put a wet washcloth or towel over your face. Head in the direction where you believe the door is. Always feel the door before opening it. If it's hot, don't open it. Find another way out. If she's locked all the doors, break a window and climb out. Always keep a fire extinguisher handy. Place it by a gun under your pillow if necessary. A fresh bucket of water nearby is also recommended. If you've been abusing your wife, it's probably best to wear only fire-retardant pajamas to bed. They might just save your life. Call the local fire department and get your name placed on the special bastard list, the roster of local men who believe they stand the best chance of being eliminated by a loved one. The fire department will then know exactly where you live and where your bedroom is. Chapter 8. We're number 1. A headline could not have been clearer. All nations on Earth sign global warming agreement. U.S. refuses. Yes, once again, the whole world hates our guts. Boo-hoo-hoo, so what's new? We're the country everyone loves to hate, and who can blame them? We obviously hate ourselves. How else can you explain President W.? In olden times, his head would already be adorning one of the bridges over the Potomac. Instead, he prances around the world telling people he's our elected leader and we just look like ignoramuses and fools. The world is laughing at us, not with us. How sad. After all, not too long ago, things were looking up for us internationally for the first time in a long while. We successfully midwifed the first peace treaty in Northern Ireland. We got the warring factions in Israel and the occupied territories to sit down and chill out. And for the first time, the Palestinians got some land of their own. We finally recognized the existence of Vietnam, though we still haven't brought ourselves to apologize for killing 3 million of their people. I guess the Germans set a bar pretty high. We were just a few million short. American pressure on South Africa had helped free Nelson Mandela, push the country toward democracy, resulting in Mandela's election as president. And finally, we returned a little boy to his father in Cuba, marking the first time a bunch of crazy Miamians didn't call the shots regarding our foreign policy in this hemisphere. Yes, I have to say things were looking pretty good for Uncle Sam in the eyes of the world, until this dolt, who we are told has never crossed an ocean in his life, took over the controls at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue. In his first 4 months in office, here's how George W. Bush dealt with the rest of the world. He reneged on our agreement with the European community to cut our carbon dioxide emissions. He started a new Cold War, this time with China, over an American spy plane that knocked one of their planes out of the sky, killing the pilot. He allowed the peace process in the Middle East to crumble, resulting in some of the worst slaughter we've ever seen between Israelis and Palestinians. He started a new Cold War with Russia by actively preparing to violate the anti-ballistic missile ABM treaties of the 1970s. He threatened to unilaterally reduce our presence in the former Yugoslavia, resulting in renewed violence between the ethnic groups in the region. He defied UN human rights agreements, resulting in the United Nations removing the United States from its Human Rights Commission. He bombed civilians in Iraq, just like Daddy did. He stepped up the drug war in South America, resulting in the United States helping the Colombians to shoot down a plane full of American missionaries, killing a Michigan mother and her child. He cut off any hope of reducing tensions with North Korea, guaranteeing not only that mass starvation there will continue, but that its leader, film nut Kim Jong-un, will never return his overdue videos to Blockbuster. He turned basically every country in the world against us by stating he was going to go ahead and build the nutty Star Wars missile defense system. All this was accomplished in less than 120 short days, and that's just in between bouts of knocking the wind out of our domestic policy, as we've already seen. Those of us who thought Junior was an underachiever have certainly been impressed by his get up and goad. Typical day in the life of President George W. Bush. 8 a.m., the President of the United States, POTUS, Rises, checks to see if he's still in White House. 8:30 a.m. Breakfast in bed. Rumsfeld reads him horoscope and comic strips. 9 a.m. Co-President Cheney stops by to help George get dressed, goes over situation in Yemen, reminds George to brush his teeth. 9:30 a.m. POTUS arrives at Oval Office, greets secretary. 9:35 a.m. POTUS leaves Oval Office to go work out in White House gym. 11 a.m. Massage and pedicure. Noon. Lunch with Baseball Commissioner Bud Selig. Selig confirms still no jobs open in front office. 1 p.m. Nap. 2:30 p.m. Photo op with Little League Team of the Day. 3 p.m. POTUS back in Oval Office to discuss legislation with members of Congress. 3:05 p.m. Meeting adjourns. Congressmen tell press meeting was very fruitful. The president told us to get some laws passed, and then he had us shag balls on the South Lawn. 3:10 p.m. Cheney briefs POTUS on energy policy, tells Junior Bush to send thank you notes to heads of oil companies. 3:12 p.m. POTUS asks to see map of the world. Seems surprised by how big the world has gotten. 3:40 p.m. POTUS has memorized all 191 capitals in less than half an hour. 3:44 p.m. Bush calls Prime Minister of Romania just because I can. Challenges Romanian Prime Minister to name capital of Burma. Prime Minister cannot understand a word he is saying as POTUS is speaking in Spanish. 3:58 p.m. POTUS accepts collect call from Austin Jail. POTUS offspring being held for desecrating portrait of POTUS as governor that hangs in state capitol building. POTUS pretends he has a bad connection, impersonates voice of a Mexican woman who has cut in on the call that hangs up, is heard to say she's a chip off the whole block. 4 p.m. Workday ends. POTUS retires to living quarters for brief catnap. 6 p.m. State dinner with African heads of state. Tells Cheney he can't think about Africa right now. It's the dark continent, you know. POTUS asks co-president to sit in for him. 6:05 p.m. POTUS goes for swim in White House pool. 7 p.m. POTUS call to Laura at Texas Ranch. Just checking in. 7:02 p.m. POTUS goes to White House screening room, watches Dave, again, falls asleep. 8:30 p.m. Cheney awakens POTUS, takes him to his room, tucks him in, says goodnight. Co-POTUS goes downstairs and resumes plotting destruction of planet Earth. So now the world is back to hating us. At least we're back on familiar ground. But on the other hand, it's a damn shame we've reverted to the role of the pariah. It was nice having foreigners think we were the good guys for once. Clinton's charm allowed us to get away with a lot. Quietly increasing the use of sweatshops and child labor in the third world by American companies, dumping unsafe products in poor countries, and exporting even worse Hollywood movies abroad. In fact, Clinton did many of the same things Bush is now doing. He just didn't rub people's faces in it. You see, Clinton was cool, so cool that most of the time, few even knew what he was up to. Clinton gave us such good cover that for a few years, Americans could travel safely in most countries without the threat of a mob chasing us down and beating the ho-hos out of us. But now, thanks to Bush's bite-me foreign policy, it's a lot harder to justify why we and the most arrogant 4% of the world's population should own more than a quarter of its wealth. If we don't watch our backs, all those uppity, emaciated foreigners are going to start thinking they deserve their own digital pagers and recessed lighting. And the doubters and naysayers who abound in oppressed countries may catch on that just the three richest men in America own more personal assets than the combined assets owned by the entire populations of the 60 poorest countries. What if the teeming billions of Asia, Africa, and Latin America get to thinking that the 1 billion of them without clean drinking water should actually have it? Do you know what that would cost? At least 25% of our Star Wars program. And what if the 30% of the world still not wired to electricity suddenly wants to screw in a light bulb and read a book? Whoa, look out. My greatest fear comes from the 50% of our fellow Earthlings who have never made a phone call. What if all of a sudden they get the idea to phone home on Mother's Day, or start tying up the lines with calls for sushi takeout? Haven't they heard there aren't any more phone numbers to go around? There's no reason to heap more anger onto these people. They're already mad enough at us, thanks to Bush's sorry performance. Plus, we got bigger fish to nuke. Whose dumb idea was it to ignore the Russians' offer 15 years ago to get rid of all nuclear weapons? Has everyone forgotten they were willing to disarm unilaterally after the old Soviet Union dissolved? Way back in 1986, before the breakup of the USSR at the summit in Iceland, Mikhail Gorbachev put on the table a goal of final elimination of the nuclear weapons by the year 2000. He couldn't make a deal with Reagan because of Reagan's refusal to give up developing, you guessed it, Star Wars. In case Reagan didn't hear him the first time, Gorbachev reiterated the offer to Bush, the elected, in 1989. To keep the peace in Europe, we need nuclear arms control, not nuclear deterrence. Best of all would be the abolition of nuclear weapons. At that time, we had lived for nearly 40 years under the constant and imminent threat of nuclear annihilation. And then suddenly one day, the commies were gone, and the Cold War was over. We were left holding more than 20,000 nuclear warheads, and the ex-Soviets had 39,000 for themselves. That was enough firepower to blow up the entire world 40 times over. I think most of us born in the baby boom grew up thinking there was probably no way we were going to get to the end of our natural lives without at least an accidental launching of one of those missiles. How could it be avoided? With that many weapons just waiting to be fired at a moment's notice, it seemed inevitable that either some nutcase with a trigger finger would hit the button, or some misunderstanding would lead to an all-out attack, or some terrorist would get his hands on the materials and set one off by himself. We cowered under a cloud of fear which affected everything we did as a nation, and we spent trillions trying to alleviate that fear by building even more weapons of mass destruction. Spending all this tax money on a bunch of useless warheads we hoped never to use, we let our schools go to hell. We failed to provide health care for our citizens, and more than half of our scientists ended up working on projects for the military instead of discovering the cure for cancer or the next great invention to improve our quality of life. The $250 billion the Pentagon plans to spend in 2001 to build 2,800 new Joint Strike Fighter planes is more than enough to pay the tuition of every college student in America. The proposed increase in monies for the Pentagon over the next 4 years is $1.6 trillion. The amount the General Accounting Office says is needed to renovate and upgrade every school in America is $112 billion. If we decided not to build the rest of the F-22 fighter jets the Air Force asked for back during the Cold War, which Clinton and now Bush the Selected still insist on funding, that money, $45 billion, would fully fund Head Start preschool for every child in America who needed it for the next 6 years. In the mid-1980s, another remarkable thing happened. Challenging Reagan to follow his lead, Gorbachev also announced that the Soviet Union would no longer test any new nuclear weapons. Gorbachev said he was taking this action whether the United States joined him or not. It was a stunning moment. Forgotten now, I'm sure, by most Americans. It was the first time any of us were given a stitch of hope that maybe we wouldn't blow ourselves to smithereens after all. The insane arms march that we started, and the Soviets felt compelled to keep up with, eventually contributed to the bankruptcy of the USSR. By the time the Soviets built their first A-bomb in 1949, the United States already had 235 of them. 10 years later, we had 15,468 nuclear weapons. The Russians were way behind, with only 1,060. But over the next 20 years, the Soviet Union spent billions more on bombs while its people shivered in the cold, and sure enough, they finally caught up with us. By 1978, they had a whopping 25,393 nuclear warheads, while we had running water, Stevie Nicks, and a comfortable 24,424 nukes. Gorbachev inherited a nation that was broke, its people hungry and yearning for the occasional roll of toilet paper. But even as the USSR was on the brink of dissolving in 1989, it was maintaining an unbelievable 39,000 nuclear warheads. The Pentagon just sat back and laughed. Our boys were fine with their measly 22,827. Was Washington's real mission to drive the communists into such poverty that their people would eventually revolt? Gorbachev, who had this figured out, threw in the towel. But it was too late. By the end of 1991, the Soviet Union was no more. In the euphoria of that moment, the new Russian and Ukrainian leaders, eager to distance themselves from the days of old, came out of the gate offering doves and olive branches to the United States. The Ukrainians said they were out of the arms race business and immediately decommissioned their warheads. The Russians turned off all the computer coordinates that had pointed their missiles at various U.S. cities. Then they offered to join the Americans in a permanent elimination of atomic weapons. And what was our response to this incredible, unprecedented offer? Zip. That did not deter the Russians. They waited patiently for an answer. They continued to wait. And they waited some more, trusting that we'd eventually take them up on their generous offer. They also hoped we might show a little compassion and send them some food, a little modern machinery, a couple of light bulbs, anything that would lift them out of their misery. They assumed we would do for them what we did for Western Europe after World War II, a relief and rebuilding effort that has resulted in a continuous and unbroken peace in Western Europe for more than 55 years, the longest in centuries. Yes, the Russians figured life was about to get a lot better, and the world a whole lot safer. Well, you know what happened. Nada. We just let them sit there and rot while the Russian mob took over. Discontent and despair grew among the people. The knight in shining armor never came as promised. Food shortages continued, the infrastructure collapsed, and the proletariat still had to run outside to take a crap. Their new president, Boris Yeltsin, turned out to be a drunk and a buffoon, and because they were unwilling to turn their country into a sweatshop for American corporations, as China had, there was no gushing pipeline of dollars flowing into the former USSR. Boris Yeltsin versus the Bush twins. We believe our Bush girls can outdrink and outsmart any of those Ruskies. Just compare their records. Bush twins, caught drinking at Austin nightclub. Yeltsin, caught drinking at G7 meeting. Bush twins, got Secret Service to spring boyfriend from jail. Yeltsin, got KGB to drive him to liquor store. Bush twins, arrested for using fake ID in order to drink. Yeltsin, never arrested, uses fake excuses to drink. Hardline politicians from the dark side of Russian politics seized office, and the opportunity to eliminate their 25,000 still operational nuclear warheads just faded away. Now, the new Russian leaders talk of building more weapons and of selling arms to Iran and North Korea. We had missed the chance of a lifetime to end an insane arms race and create a new ally in the new world order. The window of opportunity wasn't open long, and it went as fast as Rasputin rummaging through Monica Lewinsky's handbag. Monica Lewinsky, that's how we spent the latter half of the 90s, fixated on a frigging stain on a blue dress. Our Congress put aside insignificant matters like sparing the world from nuclear annihilation to focus on how exactly a commander-in-chief inserts a cigar into an intern. That is what captured our undivided attention, along with slow-moving Broncos, six-year-old strangled beauty queens, and Hugh Grant's dating habits. We had a chance to make the world safe for generations to come, but we were too greedy, enjoying the orgy being thrown on Wall Street. That's what happens in a nation of slackers and crooks. Joyfully and willingly keeping ourselves as stupid as possible about what is happening beyond the chem lawn in the front yard. After all, that's our job as leaders of the free world. But hey, don't despair. Among the top 20 industrialized nations, we're number one. We're number one in millionaires. We're number one in billionaires. We're number one in military spending. We're number one in firearm deaths. We're number one in beef production. We're number one in per capita energy use. We're number one in carbon dioxide emissions. More than Australia, Brazil, Canada, France, India, Indonesia, Germany, Italy, Mexico, and the United Kingdom combined.